everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of This Anthropological Life. I'm Anil Tripathi.
I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
And today, we're going to continue from last week's episode discussion of material objects, culture, certain material things and their value to us, whether they have meaning in social relationships or in sexual selection, as we saw with the sexy hand axes. And today, though, we're going to be looking at certain objects that might almost be characterized by the lack of thought that we put towards them. Mm-hmm. When we think about garbage, right, trash, the stuff that we discard. But what's interesting, right, is even though we might not really think about it, the way that we discard these objects actually says a lot about us.
Yeah, in this notion of disposability is kind of what we're saying, right, that we can get rid of certain objects. And certainly, you're right, when we discard some trash, we may, not give it a second thought. But, as archaeologists have shown us since the inception of archaeology, right, yesterday's trash is today's, historical treasure. We can understand sort of how people organize their lives, whether through piles of potsherds or something, right?
Exactly. Casually, sometimes I spend my evenings rummaging through Adam's garbage, trying to figure out pieces of his life.
I thought it was a raccoon, but it's just Ryan.
But besides my nightly activities, it's important to consider that waste is often something that was at one time central to our vitality, central to our life and our way of life in different areas, and that oftentimes waste is sort of the byproduct of inefficiency. That we can think about the biological processes of taking in air and breathing, but then also giving off heat. And those heat signatures that we give off, whether we're exercising or we're walking in an area with low oxygen, that's actually waste. The same when your car is burning gas too hot or burning oil too hot. And the inefficiency is shown in the amount of waste that comes out of it. So we're not necessarily that efficient, and we need these other things in order to survive in certain contexts.
Yeah, and it raises some really great questions about what things we choose to dispose of, right? Again, obviously we can't choose to dispose of oxygen or carbon dioxide when we breathe out. But we do deserve, we may choose to dispose of our mobile telephones when we want to upgrade to the new one the next year,
exactly.
Right? Or that we choose to have paper cups versus glass cups or whatever, right? But then even at the end of the year, end of whatever, you're going to throw away your glass mug too, right? So the objects are right that we choose to even make to sort of make our lives easier. It's easier to drink out of a cup than it is your hand. When we have these things, it's like all these things, again, as you said, I like the way you said it, talking about a signature, right? These things are signatures of our past activities, of what they meant to us at a certain point. So certainly for indexing what happened and like how we sort of operated in a certain space, whether it is looking at our biorhythms of our heat signatures or, again, what objects we leave behind when we're moving through a certain space, right? Leaving trash here or whatever.
Exactly. And in considering that context, all these waste materials, whatever this waste happens to be, it's always a fragment of what it once was, a fragment of something else. And again, this idea of the signature, there's so much more attached to that single piece of waste that really wasn't waste at all.
Oh, yeah, and waste could even be used to actually create itself, right? So the act of garbage and everything, garbage appreciation, certain areas can demarcate different zones, right? Such as in archaeology, right? The study of waste can be almost instrumental in figuring out, what are the main sites of activity.
Exactly. And with archaeology, you have different types of refuse, basically different types of material patternings that correspond to different ways in which people were, quote-unquote, wasting materials. So if you look at a primary deposition, just something that was intentionally placed in one area, you could look at a burial. You could find a cache of items, which is kind of like buried treasure, a really cool grouping of materials that were placed there intentionally, oftentimes for ritual purposes. And sometimes we find this in modern building practices. But that's an intentional deposit of materials that are, in some sense, waste. But more importantly is sometimes secondary refuse, which is the intentional placing of garbage. Where are we going to place this waste? How are we going to keep our streets clean? How are we going to keep our plaza clear? We're going to put these materials somewhere, and finding those places, the secondary refuse places, middens, garbage bits. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's really something. Kind of an interesting corollary example of that, since you said in terms of we want to put our waste in these certain or these secondary spaces, but this is a dump in essence, right? It's actually what we see here in New England often is when they want to keep our streets clean, not from garbage, but from snow. Of course, we've had a pretty nasty winter here, as we all know, right? And so, you know, what we see is dump trucks and bulldozers picking up piles of snow and placing them in these, we're going to call a secondary refuge space like this. It's a little different. But the idea is, of course, I notice these more because they're not supposed to be where they are. Like, you'll see an empty parking lot with a mountain of snow, right? And so it's interesting because it really tips you off saying, okay, there's human activity. Obviously, this is snow. We didn't produce the snow.
Right.
We moved it here. And it's, you know, 30 feet high. So that's obviously unusual for that amount of snow to be a little mountain right there.
And it's interesting, right, what the effects of this could be, right? Because there are people who might be disadvantaged by this, right, if anyone was really using that abandoned parking lot. But then even, you know, there are different creative aspects that can come from it. I remember when I was, you know, little, I would always love it when the snowman would come and plow the snow and have these big piles on the side, right? Because then I'd be using those piles to make little ice caves and whatnot.
Right.
There was so much possibility in that refuse or, you know, what was trying to be plowed out. Mm-hmm. And you see this even if we think about, you know, communities in India that almost survive off of refuse, right, in the recycling process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so much work has been written on, you know, slum dwellers in Mumbai and other cities that are incredibly efficient recyclers and provide almost, you know, a huge service to the community in how they're able to reuse discarded waste and actually turn it into productive value.
Right. Now, like as Adam was saying earlier, one man's garbage is another man's treasure, right? Going along with all these subjects. And humans are such great scavengers. We didn't start off, you know, making Twinkie factories and making all the crazy great foods that we do today. We started stealing food from other animals, right? Scurrying around the landscape and taking what had already been the waste of another animal and using that. Mm-hmm. So we're very good at appropriating waste as a almost instinctual type of mechanism, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's true. I mean, our evolutionary roots, right? We're not the fastest or the strongest. Arguably the smartest or not the smartest, depending on how you want to think about that, you know, as one of these unique species on the planet. But you're right. I mean, scavenging is how we survived, right? We learned to work. We talked about this, I think, back in episode 4 on violence and empathy, right? That we, in some ways, and Jeremy Rifkin talks about this, the idea that we evolved to work together. Mm-hmm. Right, and scavenging is one of the ways we did that. Right, we weren't going to fight the giant bear or the giant armadillo. Right, we're going to let them do their thing, and then we're going to get the remains when they're done eating the gazelle. Right,
exactly.
Much more efficient for us. It loses less energy. It puts the danger. The danger is full. They're hungry. They're you know, the tiger's fed. So, it's...
and then we don't create human waste bodies.
And that right.
No, it's interesting, right? Because it shows how you know, our scavenging practices, and almost we delineate how our society functions, mm-hmm. to a degree, right? If we think of how scavenging is almost instrumental in building, you know, our society, in thinking about how it relates to gathering and other forms of activity. And I think a lot of this really relates to Mary Douglas, right, in Purity mm-hmm. and Danger, and where she tries to really analyze pollution and where it exists in the structure,
uh-huh.
right? And I think when we look at how we dispose of things, it really does show these different dividing lines in society. I think Adam's point of, you know, all the snow being pushed into this abandoned parking lot is really pertinent to this. It shows us a lot about our society, where we end up putting what we think to be of as trash. And we see this,
exactly.
you know, especially in a lot of these almost global trash movements. I know the BBC, also The Guardian, have done a lot of stuff in tracking a lot of material, some of which was actually discarded in the idea that it would be recycled. BBC actually put a tracker in an old TV that was sent to a recycling center, and this TV actually ended up in Africa, right, in this massive pit of refuse, which was then actually being gone through by people to actually get scrap metal in a highly toxic environment.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that example itself, I think, really shows the political lines and the power divides in our society, and how refuse, you know, goes along these.
Yeah, and I think like these object studies is so interesting. It reminds me of Arjuna Paterai, an anthropologist who actually did his undergrad here at Brandeis. He has this notion called translocality, and the idea, of course, is that even if we're not talking about transnational migrants themselves, but the people themselves, and kind of Anil, the example you're talking about, one of the places that happens is in Ghana in Africa. And even if the people themselves may not be migrating, but translocality points to the idea of when certain, like we're talking about a place, in this case, this sort of digital dump, as they call it, right? This place that may not be directly engaged with transnational migration, but objects come into it or flow out of it, right? And those things tell a different story, right, than the people that are there. And so it's this interesting mixture of, like, what it means to be Ghanaian in this space, what it means for us actually to be American consumers of computer products, right?
Right.
They were brought together because these people and objects flow in different directions, right? Mm. And it's kind of this cool idea, I think, of translocality, that you know, these spaces we may think of, we've probably talked about space 3 times on the show, right? Space is being a fixed thing, but is it, right?
Right.
Or then the objects themselves, right? We have a physical object that is the telephone, but again, it, as it moves through these different spaces, translocally, the meaning changes behind what it is.
Exactly.
Trash to treasure, as well as, again, how people engage, whether we are trying to recycle something, quote, versus it ends up in a dump.
Very much right. Along the lines of, like, the material biographies of things, right?
Yeah.
Because getting back to another Arjuna Padurai edited volume, right? Yeah. The social life of things.
Guys, it's everywhere.
Yeah. It's very good at compiling things. Almost a recycler.
Or reuser. Books.
Exactly. We should get to him and get his social life on at some point. Yeah. But, you know, the idea of garbage is not a universal concept, right?
Right.
We're always redefining what materials mean in different contexts. And for archaeologists, this has been a bit of a problem, because not only does garbage not, you know, signify garbage across large spaces, but through time it also has different characteristics as well. Mm. So an example would be stone tools, right? If you're making a stone tool, like a sexy hand axe, quite sexy tool, you are knocking flakes off. But oftentimes those flakes are really good tools. They can be good at scraping. They can be good at making textiles. They can be good at any number of things. And we shouldn't just think of them as waste, even though sometimes we've tended to in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many things, I mean, go into, you know, how the real use value of objects is, right? And that transforms so many times. Things could be abandoned for an incredibly long period before there's an idea of use that can come in. And even, you know, objects that have almost been discarded, people's literacy in it could actually have some value in the future. You take the case of India during the Y2K crisis. India had very strict importing laws on electronics. And because of that, a lot of people there were very good at using old, you know, what we would have thought of in other countries as almost, you know, garbage electronics. These really old computer systems. And yet because of that ability to use these old systems, Indian programmers were the best people to change the systems on all the out-of-date computers in other countries, right, and resolve any issues that would have come up with the year change to 2000. So it's interesting, right, because there are these times where we might not value certain expertise or certain connections with different material objects, but then circumstances may dictate that these actually have value in the future.
Very true.
Yeah, I mean, even thinking about that from the opposite angle in terms of extractive industries, that's one of the ideas that kind of popped in my head when we were talking about doing a show on garbage and sort of disposal cultures is the extractive process, too. Whether it is making, in essence, you can think about making a stone tool. So you're extracting, right, in some ways, a shape from this rock. But at the same time, too, I'm thinking of miners of coltan in the Congo and sort of how this extractive process in coltan is a kind of metal that's used in nearly all electronic devices to make it. It's a very conductor for electricity. You see it in cell phones and computers, right, laptops, batteries too, for, you know, Toyota Prius or whatever. But the notion of all these, even like how we think about the notion of disposability in relation to extracting resources, right? Whether it is tin or gold or coltan in this case. And again, the social uses of these objects, right? Again, in the Congo, speaking around these mining communities of coltan, like it's economically destitute. I mean, neoliberalism, and when I say that, it's sort of a specific political structure that's been imposed largely by the West that has to do with privatization of resources, export-oriented economies trying to ship things out. So again, in this case, coltan or gold, you're trying to ship it out of the country. Devaluing of the currency, which then makes importing things not so good, and you want to export more things. So it's a whole economic system. We, you know, we can do details about that later. But the idea is, like, we see this, so that makes a lot of countries economically destitute. It helps, too, in some ways, but for now, we see this in Congo. It's not doing very good things.
Right.
And so because of that, these people are then using the idea of extracting coltan. We have these sort of, like, rebel mining groups. And so there's official mining company. There's one that basically operates through violence and coercion. And then these other sort of rebel mining groups that know where the coltan is, and they get together in groups of like 4 or 5 people, and they'll dig for 2 days at a time, get a little bit of the coltan out and take it and then try to sell it under the sort of like black market, right? It's the underhand of the market. But the idea, again, this object is like they're the biography of this is very different depending on who is extracting it and how, right? So how we may even appropriate this object. And then also, by the time it gets from, you know, the ground to different people's hands and it gets to us, like, we don't even see this context of the object itself, right? And then we then take the cell phone, toss it out the window, it ends up back in Ghana in a trash bin, you know? So this really interesting idea of, like, the same kind of tracing this notion of called global commodity chains, right? And the chain of this commodity use. And so these objects, these things, have these really interesting stories that go from sort of, you know, mining all the way to disposal, but then obviously the second life. And this is what, as you said, Ryan Apatari talks about, this social life of things, right? There's a commodity shelf life, but again, the thing isn't gone.
No.
It just changes meaning. And you're saying the same thing in Neil in India, right? Yeah. It just changes meaning. The object is still there, even if you may disassemble it or whatever.
Exactly. You know, it's really interesting to talk about that and then to think about Marx and commodity fetishism, right? Because oftentimes we forget how objects came to being and that mode of production and everything attached to it. So in American consumer society, oftentimes in the past with newspapers, if they were, you know, chronicling a game, right, a baseball game or the World Series, they'd print two papers, you know, one for each team winning. Well, same with all presidential elections. You know, one paper has Obama wins, the other would have Romney wins. And then what happens to the other papers, right?
Right.
You print them all off in anticipation. So I had a professor at UCF, Elaine Zorn, and she worked in Bolivia. And oftentimes she would go and find people wearing Super Bowl jerseys for the teams that lost, but saying that they won. Huh. So it'd be like, well,
parallel universe.
Exactly. Because they have to go somewhere, right?
Right. There's that famous image, I think it was Harry S. Truman wearing, holding the newspaper up and saying, you know, the other guy wins, but Truman loses. I forget what it was, but it was like this, you know, he's laughing because he obviously won the election, but it's like, you know, he lost on it. Because it's the same thing, right? So there's different ways of that. And, of course, and the thing about that in terms of disposability, right, is half the things that are produced in this case are just going to be discarded, and they know they're going to be discarded. I've seen the same thing, with NFL jerseys or hats.
Paraphernalia.
Cheese heads. Yeah, cheese heads, you know, all these things that are like, you know, Patriots win or whatever,
Packers.
Green Bay Packers win or something, and it's like, but of course they may have lost this thing, but they exist anyway because they're anticipating. We got to be able to celebrate materially.
Exactly.
I mean, can you imagine? Think about if we go think of the Maya making these stele. It's like, you know, Chacmo wins versus you know, Ixtun or something. Well, you know, they just make two of them just in case.
But the Maya had a way around this, right? So they were anticipating a future outcome by, you know, always making that cyclical connection to something in the past is like something in the present.
Smart.
So if somebody happened to, you know, sway away from what was supposed to happen, they'd be like, ah, well, this is like the other time. We got this covered.
We can justify everything, right?
It's okay. We're going in a circle here, yeah.
I think also, you know, even just extractive industries, as you were talking about earlier, Adam, it really brings a lot of these issues to light when we think about, you know, the waste involved in these extractive industries, but also the actual value of the product that's created itself. You know, like how we were thinking about cell phones, right, being created and then just discarded, you know, alternative possibility paraphernalia being created and then discarded. But then also just, you know, with certain metals such as, you know, gold and silver, right, there is this idea that there's value in it, but this value fluctuates wildly. I mean, in May we had the crash of the gold and silver markets, which was a huge crash. You know, the gold and silver had just been skyrocketing for so long, and then it just completely collapsed. And yet you have the same level of gold, right? You have the amount of gold is still in the markets, but then the way that we value it is so different, right? And these have, you know, a myriad of effects even going into the continued production and extraction of these resources.
Right. I mean, that's it's important, as you're saying, as I think we're all saying, is to link together, like, systems of value.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is financial, whether it is personal use or whatever, you know, use value versus economic value, to link those together again with the actual objects themselves,
right?
The physical telephone, or just the gold ore or whatever, right? And to recognize again this interconnection between these types of things. And that's what you're saying in terms of Marx's commodity fetishism,
exactly.
Too, right? Like, because of course it's funny when you hear the word fetish, we may think of like this weird sexual thing, you know. It's just funny, you know. It's maybe worth researching. I'm not really sure where the connection there is, but you know, what Marx is pointing to in this case, and this may be something to think about with the idea of the sexual fetish anyway, right? He's pointing to like this congealed labor, which is kind of a weird, gross term, right?
Right.
It's just like this labor that's gone into making something that then the thing itself seems to just be there.
Right.
Right. It hides the labor, or you said the means of production. It hides that this was produced.
So a PG way to maybe explain that depth, or maybe dive into it. It's like if you have a foot fetish, it'd be thinking about the foot as if it's not attached to the body, right?
Well said. Okay.
We'll leave it at that.
You heard it right here in this Anthro Life.
Very complex fetish analysis. But
it makes sense. Though, yeah.
And I think what's interesting with this also, right, is when we think about the value that's fetishized with these commodities, right, is that this value itself is seen to actually fluctuate in our markets. Right. Mm-hmm. So we have the idea of gold as, you know, this, you know, incredibly valuable object, you know, gold fever and whatnot. But then the value of gold itself has gone up and down, you know, precipitously throughout history.
For sure.
It's interesting, right, because we can have this fetish, but then this fetish carries weight in different levels at different times.
Very true. U.S. currency at one point in time was backed up by a gold standard. So you used to be able to, in some sense, trade in your dollar for its weight in gold. Hmm. We don't do that anymore.
Right.
But at one point, that there was a connection.
Oh, yeah, and the fetish never goes away, right? Even just on YouTube, I was looking for a video, and this ad video came up that was saying, you know, Americans for silver, right? And it was basically this ad trying to get you to invest in this silver holding company. Because, you know, they were saying from the beginning of the United States, you know, we've been backed by silver and this is the way it should be. And, you know, against the volatility of the market, if the U.S. economy sinks, silver will give you value that's real. Right. And that goes exactly to what we're talking about. Right. And this fetishism of the commodity of, you know, silver as a value beyond anything else. You know, this idea that somehow silver carries more weight than anything else that's traded. Yeah. In the economy.
Right.
I mean, again, just points to this kind of a more abstracting, but think about the idea of the finance system itself, right? And I think we'll be doing a show on finance at some point, or financial anthropology, but the idea of that there's this sort of abstract system of value, right, that is measurable, as you're saying, like we moved off of the gold and silver standard to this sort of credit system, right? And debt is definitely something we can talk about in the future, too. But the idea of how these things are tied to this sort of abstract system of value itself, right? Example that to kind of tie this down that makes me think about is the Zapatista movement, the rebellion that happened in Chiapas in 1994 in Mexico. One of the coolest things that they did, or most interesting things anthropologically and also socially, is that Subcomandante Marcos and like the head team, they actually would point to the stock market fluctuating when they did stuff.
Right.
They would you know sort of take over a town and then they go, look, the Western stock market crashed right now today. Or they went down today. The Dow Jones fell down today on purpose to point out the volatility of the system of value, but also why these things are connected, right? By saying if we're going to move away from the system of neoliberal governance and say we can govern ourselves better because you're not helping us. You know, you're privatizing everything, moving money resources away from us. We're going to build our own schools, et cetera, have our own financial system, et cetera, et cetera. They did that and then pointed to what seemingly is disconnected from the jungles of Chiapas to Wall Street. And there's a direct connection. Very fascinating, you know, this idea that the value, of course, is connected across these seemingly very disparate spheres, right?
Very much.
I don't know. It's a crazy point to think about, but it's like, you know, even, and so when you talk about disposability and objects themselves, it's like, as you're saying too, these different kind of gold standards and where they go up and down depending on how value changes. I mean, the story is incredibly complex, right? And it's sort of not related, but I'm interested in, we kind of mentioned talking about the idea of where we put our garbage too, you know? And I wonder what effects this has on our systems of value, right? We talked a little bit about, or we can talk about the idea of like trash and space and stuff, or like Mount Everest, or just throwing garbage in these places that seemingly trash shouldn't be. And does that affect the idea of how we think about value in that place, right? Or, you know, I mean, were there a stock of Mount Everest, you know, MTEV or something?
Will it go down with it? Well, it's funny, right? Because in some ways, the productivity of Mount Everest is what's creating this trash problem, right? It's the fact that so many people are enticed to climb Mount Everest. And because of that, you have this massive trash buildup, right, at Everest Base Camp and these different areas. In a way, it's almost a sign of success that there's trash there. But then it's interesting to think, you know, then what will the effects of this trash be going forward? And you can really think about this also with extractive industries, right? When we think about, when the extraction is gone, you know, what's left, or, you know, what this refuse, you know, what value is it in that? And it's interesting, right, because there are different examples, such as Professor Ferry's work here, we have the example of certain mines in a collective in Mexico, mm-hmm. right, that were then turned in almost, they tried to, you know, turn into almost a tourist landmark, right? Create some different sort of value with the refuse of the extractive industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, it's interesting to think about, you know, what could be the value of these things going forward, or how does it change our perceptions, right, especially with space? I think especially as you were talking about before, Adam, you know, how we create space even on Earth, right? So how we kind of mediate between space, how we use it, where we put our trash, where we do our different activities. And then even thinking about the tremendous amount of trash we put into space itself, right, yeah, is incredible to think about, especially with the significance of space and, you know, its role in the Cold War, the United States was just so driven to get people into space. And now we've done that. But we've also shot up a lot of other junk.
This is very true.
It's amazing. About it. I mean, it makes me think of that scene in WALL-E, you know, when they finally go into space, mm-hmm. and it's just the Earth is just, you know, there's like a force field of trash.
Yes.
Right? And I think that's not far-fetched.
No. You know? So an interesting way to frame this issue of where are we going to put our garbage, right, is on accessibility, let's say.
Hmm.
So with Everest, you have the issue that, you know, people can go up and clean a base camp. People can go, as Anil, you brought up earlier, but people can't go to the summit and then do a cleanup because you need that same equipment,
right, yeah.
and you need to discard that same equipment to get there in the first place.
Hmm.
And getting to the summit of Mount Everest will cost, at the minimal, $30,000.
Wow.
And it could easily go into six figures. It could easily get much higher, right? And that's for good equipment, for good guides, for the time of year. So it gets expensive,
wow.
which in and of itself might be considered a waste.
Mm-hmm.
But the other areas are much more accessible. So space becomes a concern when we're thinking about using, well, sending more people up into space. Are we going to mm-hmm. be hitting our own debris? Is this something that we need to move? And this is a big issue we also have with the breakdown of military warheads, right, of nuclear missiles. Mm. And where are we going to put that nuclear waste? And how are we going to make sure that people don't go there?
Mm. It's a great point. It's, I mean, is one of the solutions being discussed to throw it into space?
Well, I hope not. But at least not a serious one. But one of the discussions is to bury this stuff basically out in the west in a desert and then trying to come up with signs that could be legible to some sort of group of people, if they're still around, tens of thousands of years from now, when our languages are gone, when they're totally dead, when people are no longer speaking the same thing, and our social symbols may be entirely different. So how do we index danger, do not come here, in a way that doesn't say, danger, please come inside?
Right.
And that's an incredibly interesting topic, right? Because you're basically trying to create a universal index.
Right.
That would go through history almost into the future, right? So we're trying to demarcate space as being dangerous and forbidden forever and for everybody, which is, you know, it's a pretty extreme thing, right? But then it's an incredibly valuable thing to do when you think about the, you know, the toxicity of what's involved here.
Right.
It's an interesting question. I mean, because it's the play of symbols, right? Again, we're thinking about and values in some ways, right? But at the same time, too, something like danger, like what counts as danger? I mean, perhaps in tens of thousands of years, humans will be radioactive, or more so than we already are anyway.
Maybe we'll be radioactive cyborg robots with a nuclear power core.
In which case, you know, the toxicity...
The mother load.
Exactly. Yeah. No, the toxicity will actually have some value in that case.
And we may not want this nice clean air or something, you know?
Right.
Who's to say, really? Thanks, science fiction.
Yeah.
But it's
opens up possibilities.
It's a great question, you know. In kind of a big sense, it makes me think about Daniel Miller. There's a totally cool anthropologist, writes about commodities and consumption, as well as notions of value. Thinking about these symbols, of the idea of the value of danger in this case, right? Or, again, of anything we've been talking about, cell phones or whatever, or even whether we should clean up Mount Everest, right? As Anil said, the provocative point that, like, the trash is indicative of its success, right? And we may think of the same thing of maybe Cancun, Mexico, too, right? It's maybe successful. We do see garbage, and we say that's a problem, but at the same time, that's a sign of its touristic success, too.
Right.
And that raises interesting questions of, like, what is the value, then, of garbage, of these kinds of things? And Debna Miller, he's an interesting piece that's called The Uses of Value, because this is kind of talking about what does value do for us? Like, how much do I value something? And he says that it's hard when you talk about, because value can be, as we've been saying throughout the show, like how much we value safety, how right. much we value cleanliness, what something is worth financially or use value to us. All kinds. I mean, value can go in all these different directions. And so what he says to kind of what can be useful to think about is how value itself acts as an index between what we may say is something is valuable that is alienable from us, which I'll talk about, or we right. can talk about in a second together through Marx, versus what our values are, which are inalienable, mm-hmm. what I believe in, versus my labor can be alienable. So you guys help me talk through this. But so alienability, according to Marx, right, is the idea that when the workers alienate from their labor in terms of that they work for a wage, and exactly. that they don't own their own means of production, right? They make something in a factory, for his example, right? And then that product moves on. They're making cell phones, just for
right.
saying, right? And
as opposed to art, if you were going to sculpt a piece and mm-hmm. you would then sell that to somebody else, it would be you sculpt the piece, but then it's no longer yours. The price tag is determined by other factors, by other yeah. people, and you get back to sculpting.
Yeah, and so then that way that's inalienable, right? That mm-hmm. matters. You produce something. The same thing actually with subsistence farming, right? If you
right.
produce your own food, that is an inalienable product, right? And the thing that you can then sell for money, of course, but then the idea is you're producing something. Alienable labor, right, is when you're working for wage, which most of us do anyway.
Right.
Right? We go work at a store for the summertime. We're trying to sell whatever, you know, sell lava lamps to people in a mall or whatever.
Store.
The lava lamp store. You know,
it's interesting, though, right?
Or beanbags.
Even
know?
In our labor, though, sometimes we'll always try to create something that's inalienable.
Indeed.
Right?
Right.
Like if we're a barista, maybe we want to be the best coffee
right.
mocha maker in the world.
Or we believe in that coffee becomes, product.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So we're always trying to, you know, even take on roles, you know, say, I am the policeman, I'm the mailman.
Right.
You know, we try to take our work and create it, you know, make it part of our identity.
Right. And that's what Miller's saying, right? Mm-hmm. Value points us in this. It's a good bridge between the alienable and the inalienable, right? Like, we're just selling our labor, but at the same time, I'm making something of myself by doing this job. Right?
Exactly.
And so it's a really great question to think about objects themselves, too, right? Because, again, I didn't make my cell phone, you know, and I know the story somewhat of myself when it's problematic, right? We, you know, talk about Foxconn and sort of the different controversies I have an iPhone and the sort of kind of harsh labor practice for some, but other people may find value in working in this kind of place. I mean, mm-hmm. there's been really interesting documentaries back and forth about things at Foxconn, as well as actually with the making of Mardi Gras beads. Right? There's a
right.
great documentary called Mardi Gras Made in China. Really great documentary, you know, that documents, you know, people in New Orleans having a good old time, you know, throwing beads and the kind of the culture of crazitude that comes with that. And then the documentary goes to the factory in China where the beads are made. And we in the U.S., some of us may say, well, those are long working hours for low pay and these kind of things. But again, the focus is partially on that, but also, again, how the workers themselves find meaning in their own lives, right? Again, it's a very important point anthropologically to, you know, not shoot our values onto somebody else, but uh-huh. also recognize the fact that the types of labor that's being promoted is, you know, also promoted by the kind of products that we demand, too. So there's a really, this is a complex thing, but, you know, the back and forth between, like, mm-hmm. what values are being used here. But kind of great documentaries and just thinking about, it's more of a complex point than I should make right now, I guess, but like an interesting idea of value here, right? That or the products themselves, like, I mean, what do they show? Are they an index of the kinds of things that we want or the kinds of lives that people make and the kinds of lives that we demand to have, other people demand to have? Like, they sort of clash over these physical objects, right? The beads in this case, or the cell phone, or whatever.
Right.
Right? These things bring us together. We're like a Paterized Translocality, I was saying mm-hmm. before. It's like, you know, the object connects us in some ways, right? And we do see competing systems of values, right? We would say, well, we want to have an inalienable life. I want to believe that I'm a good cell phone user or whatever, you know, that I can work hard and use my cell phone to type notes for this Anthro Life or whatever, you know, so we can say I'm using this product in a good way. You
yeah,
know?
You have your own special apps and everything on your
yeah,
phone.
That's, right?
you know, your personal connection to it.
Right. But yeah. again, there's the bigger question, the bigger picture, right, of where this device even came from,
oh, yeah.
right?
I think, I mean, this discussion, it's really fascinating. I think it brings up, you know, so many points that are really vital to any discussion of material culture, material objects, and what the possibilities are for these objects, even in the future. And if we think about this in the relation of the Mount Everest example, right, and the trash, we also can almost open up new possibilities for this trash, right? So we
right.
can think of environmental groups that will then go to Mount Everest as a trip, right, to go clean up this trash. And that in itself is a new activity, right? And it's an activity brought about by this trash, right? They're going there because there's trash there.
Yeah.
You know, it gives a meaning to the effort. And then they're engaging in an activity which fundamentally engages also something of their inalienable identity, or what they hope is their inalienable identity, right? They're trying to craft themselves as environmentalists, as activists, as people who care about the planet. And this identity is almost, you know, it's solidified through these different acts. And one way it is through this is in engaging these other objects, right, this trash, in its lack of value. Right? So you're something of no value creating value through this interchange.
That's true. It's really interesting to think about how value is coming out of what we should do with that trash, and how we can think of ways it could actually increase, you know, jobs, and could increase growth in certain ways of how we want to handle these materials, right? Recycling had a big kick in the 90s, and, you know, we all still do it, I hope. And but, you know, that really wasn't a thing before then in America, right? People are now hopefully sticking with that to make more materials out of these wasteful uses, or to be more conscious of them in order to promote, you know, an idea of what we think is better for the environment, what we think is better for us. This could be said with any type of materials that we find, like the plastic rings around Coke bottles, for example, right? Cutting those up they're not hurting the environment. And that's a valuable activity. But that same plastic can also be then taken and used to create something else that's equally valuable, that should hopefully get reused and reused and reused.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's in some ways, yeah, it comes back to the idea of Mary Douglas, right? It's like this, you know, she says that dirt is matter out of place, right? So he's that trash in this way. In some ways, like, can be both matter out of place, but also matter in place. It can be made to be, into place. Yeah, it creates place in some ways. So it's cool to think about the generative capacity of garbage too, or waste, right? And there's, I mean, the whole field of study called garbology, which is
true.
Cool, you know?
Started by William Rathje back in the 1970s.
Yeah, it was a good decade. Garbage studies and disco. But, you know, it's just like, it's an interesting idea of, like, the, as you're saying, cause, I mean, that these things index, like, both what was used and also the generative possibilities of something new. Of course, I think it is maybe a little more difficult for us to imagine, like, what would you do with a bunch of styrofoam plates from McDonald's? Because it raises interesting questions about what kinds of things we do make trash out of, too. Because there's a movement, you know, there's a petition, you know, in terms of, is it called slacktivism, where you just kind of, you check out positions online?
Oh, yeah, lots of online polling.
Yeah, it's like lacktivism or slacktivism or something, but, which still good, I mean, still sign petitions, you know, but like, but one of the things was to get Dunkin' Donuts to stop using styrofoam cups. And most other coffee companies, I think, you know, Starbucks or Einstein's or...
paper, right?
They use paper. I mean, is it better ostensibly? I think so. But... It's an interesting question of, like, you know, why do certain companies hold out? And what's really interesting, to bring it back to value, too, with this idea of styrofoam waste, is that Dunkin' Donuts used, they sort of said, that, well, this is the quote, working man's coffee. This is, America runs on Dunkin', you know. And the idea is that, as their tagline says, right, and that, like, that styrofoam is, like, this is the working person's material. We need this. Like, this is, it's tough. It's easy to use. You know, paper is kind of like this extra thing, you know. A really interesting argument.
It's interesting. When I was in North Carolina a couple of weeks ago, I went to a random coffee shop and was given a styrofoam cup. And on that, it had a label saying that, you know, styrofoam cups release less CO2 into the air than the burning of plastic cups like a Starbucks cup. So that it was actually better for the environment in recycling processes.
Interesting.
Than, you know, the regular paper cup like this one in my hand would have been. So... It's curious,
you know. I mean, I think we should definitely do a show on the production of facts at some point.
It's
a great thing to think about, because it's a debate in terms of what exactly is quote true here, and, you know, what are we using to index that truth? Scientific facts made from what?
Right.
You know, for whom? From what audience? What
exactly?
What criteria
What's
is used?
What's the
to,
angle?
Yeah. And so, as much as we love facts and science and truth as anthropologists, you know, we recognize these things are socially constructed the same way that belief systems or value systems, you know, that say we need subsistence farming versus something else. You know, doesn't mean they're untrue by any means, of course.
No,
I think we've said this before in the show.
Yeah. And it's interesting, right, in this case, because you see these facts then fetishize into the material itself.
Right.
Right, with it being written into the cup. And, you know, it's being written is predicated on the fact that this discussion even began in the first place, right? So that little snippet of information wouldn't have been there if it weren't for, you know, people being involved environmentally with other products and other cups saying, you know, this cup is incredibly eco-friendly and whatnot. It creates this dialogue, right, which then has to be responded to by other materials.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Reminds me of Idiocracy. Have either of you seen this yeah. movie?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And there's a part where, a big theme of it is that this version of Gatorade is good for plants because its tagline is, it's, you know, what plants crave.
Right.
But it's not good for plants at all.
No. It's a great point. Yeah, there's a Mike Judge film, I think, after the Office Space, yeah, and King of the Hill. But it's really, it's a dumb but funny film, yeah, because it points to the idea of, like, you know, how facts can just be used and really, you know, over
exactly.
time they can just compound into being something really ridiculous. It raises a provocative point for being such a silly comedy, you know, and you're right. It's like, plants don't need Gatorade. Nobody needs Gatorade. You know, electrolytes are nice to have, but you don't need to get that from Gatorade.
Exactly.
Plants certainly don't need that, but you're right. It's a great idea to think about. I guess I'm thinking in terms of trash, too, and the, sort of the reusing of trash as well. There's some interesting examples from migrant communities from rural parts of Peru into Lima. And Lima is one-third of the country lives around the city.
Yes.
It's a huge population of millions of people. And the city has expanded so rapidly because people tend to move in squatter settlements, and like usually one or two families will come at a time. This happened more so in the 50s to the 70s. It still happens now, though. And they would move in at a little bit of time, and then when they realized it was kind of a safe space, their whole village would come with them then. And so we saw it in Bolivia, too, actually, around El Alto. And so you see these cities, like, blow up overnight because, like, hundreds of thousands of people would come because, actually, they ended up closing mines and getting rid of
right.
of employment. But then there's a really kind of interesting case from a book that was called A House of My Own by Sarah Lobo, maybe. It's been a while since I read it.
We'll look into it.
We'll look into it, yeah. We'll put it up on the blog. But she points out that there's a particularly interesting example in which a group of people move on top of a dump. And people say, you can't move there, it's a dump. You know. And they say, well, we're doing this. And they stake their claim. And it's interesting because they actually then recycled most of the materials into making houses. And then eventually they ended up, quote, cleaning the area, if you want to call it that, by moving objects. And then over time, that actually became a prosperous middle-class neighborhood. And it took 20 years. But the idea is, like, so they moved out, and they first said you couldn't do that. But then they did the sort of the traditional practice of come staking your claim. And then they turned this, or they repurposed, we could say, this garbage, right, into an unintended recycling into a neighborhood.
Very fascinating.
Yeah.
It's amazing what people can do with, you know, things we might consider waste in terms of making, like, good and productive housing, too. I've seen examples where people have taken 2 liters and basically created concrete walls that are that are sectioned off, by these 2 liters so that the concrete's not used in abundance, but it creates an equally strong wall that could even withstand hurricane-force winds.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool how we can use what might be garbage to create something that's really not, that's very stable and good.
Yeah. I mean, even because it makes us raise the question of, like, wouldn't these people want to have bricks or glass? But again, these are manufactured things too, right? Again, think about commodity fetishism, right? Bricks and glass have to be made.
Right.
Particularly glass. I mean, you know, obviously it's made in volcanic mountains, but you know, we're not gonna go, you don't get windows from a volcano. You know, so it's
it didn't work out too well for Pompeii.
No, it didn't, exactly. So example, case in point, Pompeii. Right, but these things are manufactured too by giant multinational corporations. You know, steel industry is multi-billion-dollar industry.
Yes.
And so it's interesting that we think about this sort of these quote modern materials or the best or whatever. But really, again, these we must realize there are stories behind these objects as well, right?
Mm. You know, exactly.
There's not just bricks. There's not just glass.
No, definitely.
Well, they're also more adapted to the way in which we do things because we like to do things the way we do them, and we want to keep, you know, our own methods.
Mm-hmm. We want standardization.
Exactly.
Right? Especially, I mean, companies especially
particularly
want
for market
standardization.
Purposes, right?
Exactly. I mean, think about drywall and all of these things.
Exactly. It's like the assembly line. Mm-hmm. The idea that you can just have one thing move to another quick and efficiently. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's the best.
Right.
That doesn't mean it has that same type of barista care involved that I want to make the best craft coffee ever. It's just, well, let's push it through.
Yeah.
Because it's easier. It's quicker.
The process is there so it can go.
Exactly.
I mean, this is something we pointed out on episode 10, I think, from our beer, the Beerscape, yes. was that bottling itself was invented by the beer industry, or I mean not bottling, sorry, bottling, but the assembly line process, right? It's attributed to Ford, but really it was because of the beer industry. They needed to crank out bottles quickly. And again, it just makes me think. I mean, I assume that beer bottles are a really great way to hold beer, but perhaps there's a better way. I don't know.
Beer bottles are great, especially if you recycle them and they go back to bottling that same beer.
That's a great point.
Bring back your deposit beer bottles.
Although it's interesting, right, the politics behind some of these deposit beer bottles. I know one liquor store near my house, they will only accept the bottles if the barcode is still on it.
Right.
Because that's to prove that you bought it from that place, right?
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, if you could have the same bottle, right? I mean, I have this bizarre habit. I'll, like, play with the label when I'm drinking. So then I, like, you know, tear it off. And if I bring that to the recycling center, they won't take that bottle. You know, it's the exact same bottle as the ones that are being recycled.
Right.
But they won't take it because there's no label on it.
Hmm.
Right? So it's this different dynamics of trash that then has an effect.
It is, yeah. It's like, how can you identify it as trash or as appropriate trash, right? And it's true, and it's funny because the label is the easiest thing to remove on a beer bottle. You know?
Exactly.
You can either break the bottle, which is one way of getting rid of it, or removing the label.
Yeah.
Particularly when you have a cold beer on a hot day, it gets, you know, the bottle sweats anyway, so the label just tends to come off. So it's interesting, you know, like how we better recycle bottles, maybe. I don't know.
Mm. And, you know, I saw the other day that a lot of people now make their bottles in the candle holders, right? So you take your bottle and you run it under a faucet with a hot string, and you can cut it in half effectively. And then your bottle, you have a place to put a candle in, so long as you smooth the edges. And
certain wine bottles are actually renowned for this, right? Like everyone back in the day would have a bottle of Chianti, which they dumped out, which has, you know, the nice straw bottom.
Oh, yes.
And then that would be the candle holder.
Right.
So, you know, it's interesting, right, how some things are even mythologized almost in their different, you know, recycling abilities. Or, you know, they have all that stuff online all the time where they'll be saying, you know, life hacks. And there'll be a list of things that you can do with certain objects to make your life easier. And one of the examples is, you know, using the tap openers on beer cans or soda cans to organize your wires, right? Because there are those two holes. You can use it to organize your wires for your electrical devices.
Ah, interesting.
That's interesting.
Yes. So it's, I mean, so, you know, throughout our society, there are all these ideas of recycling, right? And these ideas, you know, and they then give people meaning, or they give people the impetus to act physically with the material culture that they have. And I think, you know, this, it's very interesting when we think about these different modes of production, right? When we think of the standardized industrial practices which lead to things such as bricks or cement blocks or steel, where there's this, you know, impetus for standardization. And then, you know, it'll be interesting to see, I think, where our economy goes with the recycling industry and what possibilities emerge. And definitely, I mean, right now with different talks of environmental degradation, there's a huge amount of focus on this, right? How can we recycle products better? How can we increase more value in these industries? Especially within capitalism, right, there's always this need for growth. So then will the growth of the future really be primarily from recycling if we see a future where we really need to cut back on production for just, you know, the basic reasons of we need to conserve our planet?
Yeah, there's a really interesting a doomed note to leave us on. but NASA just came out with a report that was basically said that life on Earth is for humans, is heading in a bad direction, you know, which you kind of know anyway. But but what they said, which is interesting, and that ties directly what you're saying, Anil, is that this push towards recycling and these kind of, like, or in other words, in sort of you know, preserve, conserve, whatever verb you want, the environment, we strive for more efficient means of production, right? But so, which is good, and that's a positive. But what that does then, if there's more efficient ways of producing something, then it is matched by the level of consumption that goes up with the efficiency of production. Because if it's cheaper and easier to make something, more people are going to get it. So it raises an interesting question of, like, we are being more efficient with certain things, but because of that, more people are consuming it, and so they match each other. And so, like, there's this interesting balance that we have to be careful for, because they're like, they just said, it's going up anyway. Like, we may be being more efficient, but more people using the same thing, so it doesn't make a difference. It's really an interesting, bigger question that we can solve in this anthropological life. But
it's a challenge. It's a challenge that I think ties into our overall theme for this semester, which has been changing states, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So
that's
the
true.
Changing states of our changing consumption, our changing products, our creating changing states that we have to address. And these are problems that we won't solve today.
That's a great point. Speaking of changing states, I think next time we're going to come back with a special report, special show that's actually on Russia and Ukraine to talk about sort of the move of Crimea. Speaking of changing states, literally, or federations or whatever.
There are many claims being made on both sides.
Indeed. Indeed.
Who knows what the state of affairs will be next week.
That's true.
Yeah. Now it's a continuous issue. Well, yeah, I think, you know, we went over a ton of awesome ideas in this episode, from the creation of products, the recycling, to all the possibilities in between.
Yeah, value in commodities and changes in time. Yeah, it's been a crazy episode, but it's been fun, gentlemen.
Without a doubt.
Exactly. Garbage, right. Waste, production, exchange, space, Everest, frontiers, beyond.
We keep making more ground for the anthropological insights.
And the beerscape was here again.
Yeah. They're giving us
keeps going. Continued recycling of our older ideas.
Exactly.
All right, guys. So I think that's all we have time for this week. Join us next week, same time, same place, for This Anthropological Life. Once again, this is Anil Tripathi.
This is Ryan Collins.
And this is Adam Gamble.
Catch you guys next week.